Hello, everyone. Scott Myers here at the Self-Storage Academy, which is being held live in Orlando, Florida, March 31st through April 2nd, and I want you to be there. Listen, there has never been a better time to invest in self-storage, and there is no better team than ours to show you how to do it, because we wrote the book on how to invest in self-storage. Literally, I created the best-selling home study system back in 2007, titled How to Find, Evaluate, Purchase, and Manage Self-Storage Facilities. And since then, we have helped thousands of people launch and scale their self-storage business and have now become the nation's go-to resource for all things self-storage. And that's because we not only talk the talk, we walk the walk. Day in and day out since 2005 through now two recessions and amassing 2.5 million square feet of self-storage, totaling over 15,000 doors nationwide. There is nobody else that has more experience in self-storage that is teaching people how to invest in self-storage than our team. So if you're ready to launch and scale your self-storage business, then go to selfstorageinvesting.com. Click on the events tab to grab your ticket to the upcoming Self-Storage Academy in Orlando. That's March 31st through April 2nd, along with tickets to our virtual academy for those who can't make it or just aren't ready to go live at this time. So that, again, is selfstorageinvesting.com. Click on the event tab, but do it now as seating is limited and we have sold out every academy since 2008, so go do it now. And on behalf of my team, we look forward to seeing you then. Take care.
This is the Self-Storage Podcast, where we share the knowledge and skills from the industry's leading investors, developers, and operators to help you launch and grow your self-storage business. I'm your host, Scott Myers, and over the past 16 years, we have acquired, developed, converted, and syndicated over 2 million square feet of self-storage nationwide with the help of my incredible team at selfstorageinvesting.com, who has helped thousands of people achieve greatness in self-storage.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Self-Storage Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Myers, and this week's guest is Nick Huber. Nick was born in Leopold, Indiana, and went to school at Cornell, where he ran track and founded his first company, Storage Squad. He and his partner grew that business to 25 major college towns before they sold the business in early of 2021. While they were running the service business, they also built their first self-storage facility in Ithaca, New York, from the ground up and opened it for business back in 2017. After selling the company, he turned his full-time attention to real estate, private equity, and self-storage operations. And currently, his brand, Bolt Storage, owns 42 properties totaling over 1 million square feet with 34 employees. He and his partner are investing heavily in their processes and their team right now as they are betting on the fact that 10 years from now, the big players will give remote management a shot. That will open up Pandora's box when it comes to the value of these smaller, classy assets like theirs. And Nick's goal is to have 500 stores by then to capitalize on his prediction. Nick is also the host of The Sweaty Startup and owns several other companies in different industries that have created multiple income streams for he and his partners. So without further ado, please enjoy this wide-ranging conversation on all things self-storage with Nick Huber. Hey, Nick, welcome to the show.
Scott, thanks for having me. I'm a big fan of your work, a lot of respect for what you do, and the community you're building has a special place in my heart, obviously, because we share a lot of similar interests.
Well, likewise, obviously, similar interests and very similar businesses and even background as well. But I shared your bio on podcast here, but if you would, why don't you fill in some of the gaps and then let us know a little bit about what you're doing, how you ended up 2021 and what you're looking forward to in 2022.
Yeah, so I'm 32 years old, was born in Southern Indiana, went to school in Ithaca, New York at Cornell, met my business partner where we started a small business pickup and delivery student storage called Storage Squad. Learned that business, grew it. At its peak, it was doing about $2.5 million a year in sales. 2015, we put the proceeds of that business into our first self-storage foray. It was a development. We've since gotten away from development. It's our only one we've ever done. And then got serious about self-storage, realized how good of a business it was, applied our operational chops, acquired a couple more facilities in 2018, a couple more in 2019, 2020, we accelerated a bit more. And 2021 was the roller coaster where we acquired $50 million worth of storage and grew to 42 properties. And now we're a full-fledged real estate private equity company and operations company. We have 32 employees. We're fully remote. We're all over the country. And yeah, I think everybody, right? 2021 was a phenomenal year for self-storage. So it's been a heck of a ride.
I would agree. We had an incredible amount of growth during that year. We also sold some properties off at the end, and we're looking to do just equal that amount this year, both acquisitions as well as dispositions. But Nick, you got into the business maybe a little bit differently than other folks, not only just because you had the portable storage or the delivery storage, but when most folks start out with a physical storage business, they usually start out with one, two, a handful of existing facilities. You just went all in with development first. But then also, I picked up on, you mentioned that that's the first and only one you've done. So tell us how that project went and why your decision to go into now just existing facilities rather than revisit development.
Yeah. So we built a building, a big building. My father works for a developer and he is energetic, lively guy. He got us all excited about building and putting some of our capital to work. So we jumped in, we built a building on a $1.7 million budget. We ended up spending $2.4 million. So it was quite a nightmare from that perspective. Had to go back to all of our LPs, ask for more money. But once we got the doors open and got it rolling in 2017, it started going really well. We are operators at heart. We're good at getting customers. We're good at leasing units. We're good at managing the building. Fast forward to 2019, the building's worth $5 million. We do a cash out refi, put $2 million in our pocket to go buy and build more storage. We tried to build two more projects, and zoning and land issues and a city rezoned us out from under us, basically sunk $200,000 in a full year of my life into a couple projects that did not happen. And that's when we said, you know what? Why the heck would we build for $50 or $60 a foot when we can buy for $50 or $60 a foot? It's a little bit different now, but that was our mindset in 2019. So we shifted gears and we held on to that first building. It's been a massive success. We're about to do another refi. It's worth about $9 million now. So that was kind of career changing money for my partner and I and our initial LPs. And we've since really grown. But yeah, I think when it comes to the decision between development and acquisition, development can be very, very rewarding financially. You can do very well. But from the time we outlaid our first dollar in 2015 to the time we made money in 2019 was a very, very long time. And you can buy assets nowadays that are mismanaged and you can drive revenue a bit, cut expenses a bit, and you have something more valuable than you had before, even 6 months later. So from a risk perspective, especially in a little bit of a frothy economic environment now where rates are at all-time lows, we just feel that the best risk-adjusted return right now is acquiring stabilized assets with a little bit of value left for us to add.
And a good strategy. At some point, I think you realize that. And you're right, we're in a little different environment right now. But when you look at the actual development cost and a time it being more, we're more sensitive to time than anything else. Not only a development project when we head into it, but then also how many of those development projects we take on and how to meter that out with regards to development and existing facilities. And that only comes with time and experience to really recognize what that looks like. Right now, fortunately, we've had some folks that we're building these things. And as soon as we get certificate of occupancy, we're having folks that are buying them at roughly the 5-year stabilized price. And so a little bit of an anomaly, but nevertheless, I'm always looking at the pipeline and what is to come. And so one of the other pieces that I wanted to touch on, you've done an incredible job and nobody gets to that place where you have right now and we have and that growth without raising private equity. And you had mentioned you're at the place where we arrived probably the same time, which is at some point you make that shift. You realize you have to, if you're going to grow, you have to raise private equity. But then all of a sudden you recognize that when you grow up, we're a private equity firm and we're a financial services firm that deploys capital in self-storage. Tell us when you began using, I guess, that lingo and when that shift came about in the organization and then how you staffed for that as you found that place and had that recognition.
Yeah, I didn't come from a real estate background. My dad was a developer, but he was not in the weeds on financials at all. He was kind of a construction manager, right? So I didn't know the lingo. I didn't know how it worked as early as 5 years ago when we did our first deal. Very soon, I realized that this is a very capital intensive business. We need to go out and raise some money. But I, again, did not have that in my network. So oddly enough, a lot of our investment and our access to capital, and now most people who do a good job in real estate are flush with capital, it came from my work on Twitter, oddly enough. I tweet about small business and self-storage. I'm really serious about Twitter. It's a business for me. It's probably been the highest value work that I've done over the past year. And if you want to hear more about that journey, I have a full talk on that on YouTube. If you Google Nick Huber, Moses Kagan, we're at Reconvene, a conference where we talk about kind of the journey with Twitter and how we leveraged that to raise money. But yeah, so did our first deal with outside capital in 2020, November. 18 and 19, we just bought with our own money, a couple small assets. And then the floodgates opened and we started doing really well. We started beating our projections and we started doing more deals. And the insane appetite for capital came in. I also had a mentor, or the insane appetite from capital for yield for self-storage started becoming evident. And I had a mentor who runs a big real estate private equity shop in Fort Worth, Texas called Chris Powers. His name is Chris Powers. He also has a social media presence and a podcast if you want to catch up with him. He kind of taught me what it took to build a healthy real estate private equity company from charging the right fees, setting up the right structure with the pref and the promote, and making sure that you have a sustainable business that, hey, you don't need to keep doing deals forever to make money, right? You can manage your assets, you can manage your capital, and you can find a way to build a healthy company in itself. So now every deal we do, we kind of look at it from a 3-prong approach, right? We need to make money from a management perspective. Our management company, which is about 22 of our people on our team, need to make money. Our real estate private equity company needs to make money. And then our LPs need to make money, right? So if a deal can't feed all three of those people, we can't do the deal. So it's kind of forced me to really think about business in a sustainable way.
Mm-hmm. So folks get to a certain level, if you're investing around the country, like many of us do, and that is one of the beauties of self-storage, is that it's not super management and labor intensive, that it is a little bit easier of an asset class, not easy to manage, but an easier asset class to be able to develop and or purchase in other states and then have a third-party property management company handle those. But you built out a property management company. Did you start with third-party first and then have the realization that, hey, if we want to own and control this and control our numbers and our destiny and meet our projections, we have to bring this in-house? Had it always been that way from the beginning, or if not, when did you make that shift?
We've been operators at heart from the very beginning. Our first business was a sweaty startup, a small business, and it was a hard business. We had to have trucks. We had to have college students driving those trucks. We had to be at students' dorms at the right time to pick up their stuff in 12 cities at once, and it was very seasonal. So we felt really comfortable managing self-storage, and we did it from the beginning. And we feel like that is what really allows us to succeed. We drive revenue faster than a lot of the third-party managers. We lease units better than third-party managers. We keep costs low. You know, our institutional competitors down the street are spending $80,000 to $120,000 a year in payroll, and we're spending $3,000 to $5,000 a year on-site payroll, right? So it can be a tremendous advantage when you get operations right and you do that stuff in-house. So I think the management fees that we charge our entities, they're separate businesses, right? Every deal we buy is the LLC that we're the GP on. We also have a co-invest, and it contracts with our property management company at anywhere from 12 to 15% of revenue as the all-in fee to get that property managed. So that's kind of how we think about it.
At the end of the day, nobody cares 1% as much about your property as you do. And so if you have the ability to bring that in-house and control that and manage that, I never say never, never say always, but the way I've seen it, it is always a better way to be able to do that. So Let's talk about the private equity firm as well in that company. So when did you begin to truly separate that out and then determine, without knowing what your organizational structure or your accountability chart looks like for that company, when did you hire somebody to run that and then recognize that, hey, if we're going to raise capital, we really need to have a concerted effort in social media by way of Twitter and LinkedIn, as you mentioned, you know, to grow that list. Tell us about the genesis of the PE firm.
Yeah, I think it became clear that we were going to have the ability to raise a lot of money in January of this year. That's when I started staffing up an underwriting team, acquisitions team, and a CFO. And that's kind of our system, right? The acquisitions guys are bird dogging deals. We're getting them into our underwriting pipeline. And then from there, it's going to our CFO to say, okay, this is exactly what we can offer. That was kind of an uncomfortable hire about 6 months ago of like, hey, somebody might take my job, because that's what I did. I was underwriting all the deals and I was talking to all the LPs. Now our CFO does those things. He's doing a phenomenal job. And it's kind of about taking that leap of trust right off the cliff of, hey, it's not me and nobody's going to be able to treat my business like I do, but you can find really good talent who thinks about things the right way, empower them. And so that's what happened. Our CFO is phenomenal. And that's when we built a system. I mean, we're talking 1% AUM fees on every dollar we raise, 2.5% acquisition fee on everything we buy, a co-invest on top of that, where we're putting a little bit of our own capital to work. And we use Juniper Square to run the deal, because being able to send these distributions and updates and checks, I mean, we have 200 active investors now that need a check every 3 months, right? So sending out paper checks is not feasible unless we want to have 5 or 10 people in our back office. So our real estate private equity company, including acquisitions, which is 3 people, 2 people in the background. So 5 people in acquisitions. And then we have 3 more in finance as far as our real estate private equity company goes. We raised just over $22 million in outside capital in 2021.
Let's talk a little bit about the back office. I want to drill down on that just for a minute. Juniper Square is, you mentioned, that using to handle the back office. What do they do for you? And tell us about that decision to offer that third party versus bringing some of those folks in-house.
Yeah, I think the option was either run this whole thing on Excel myself. And You know, obviously, we're using QuickBooks for financials. So we're exporting QuickBooks. We're seeing how much net operating income we have. We're looking at bank statements. We're getting those straightened away. And then we send out distributions every quarter. And It became a real pain to get the right reporting and the right login dashboard and the right ability for our LPs to actually fund deals and manage these deals. Because in December, we raised $12 million of outside capital in December because of so many closings at the end of this year. It would not have physically been possible without Juniper Square. I mean, we uploaded our deal deck, we sent out emails inside of Juniper Square, and then the LPs actually made their commitments and funded and wired their commitments inside of Juniper Square. So, and then they can log in and they can look at all their investments, how much has been distributed for each. All their K-1s are right in there as well. It just saves tons of time. It is a software built around syndicating. It's designed for syndicators.
We've looked at many, and one of the, I don't know if it's a fun thing, it's definitely a necessary thing, but there's many, many tools out there. And as I talk with other syndicators and real estate investors, there's a lot of software available, a lot of resources, a lot of apps. And finding the right one, always the biggest challenge. And something like a Juniper Square, if you're looking at the back office, party admin of a fund, that is not a decision that you want to make multiple times. We want to make that once. Because if you like yourself, you've got 200 people in there, that's the last thing you want to do is ever having to jump ship and move over somewhere else. So Nick, share with us, what are some of the other tools that you're using for a business your size to either manage a deal flow from underwriting, property management software systems? Yep. If you would take a few minutes and share what you're using in your business right now, so the other folks that are also going through perhaps this process and a little bit of brain damage can maybe nail down and get a little closer to what it is that some of the folks out there are using.
Yeah, so we're using Google Maps and spreadsheets to call facilities and deal with our, organize our acquisitions pipeline. Then we're using Google Sheets. Now,
wait a minute. You don't have to have a sophisticated pipeline software and spreadsheet and anything else to go out and begin making your calling. What are all these new folks going to learn from that, Nick? You can just pick up the phone and start calling?
I think people overcomplicate a lot of different businesses. I mean, that's why you and I are not afraid to get on here and talk about what we do, because this is not rocket science, right? We go out and we talk to owners and we talk to brokers, we underwrite deals, we make offers, we close offers, and then you try to keep the place clean and rent units. And that's about as simple as everything that we do. We have 31 people and every single one of them, we have 32 starting tomorrow, but every single one of them has a job in relation to one of those things that I just said.
Yeah, at the end of the day, and we teach a lot of people about the business in our education company as well, and they feel that they need to get a brand and then a logo and conduct a small little test group with all the neighbors and friends to see the colors on the logo and the brand and the name and the LLC and entity. And they said, well, that's about 7 or 8 steps down the line. You need to find a deal before you do any of that. So you need to begin marketing and pick up the phone and begin calling. But you're right. I think too many people, they do overcomplicate it. And at the end of the day, execution is what wins out. Speed and the speed at which you execute is what wins out, period.
Yeah, we'll keep going down that path. Our CFO quarterbacks the deal leading up to closing. We're doing due diligence. We're meeting with an owner. We're having 2 meetings with the owner to go over the rent roll, to go over contractors, to go over any issues with the property. And then on closing day, we're getting everybody into our software. We use Easy Storage Solutions now. We're on the fence of switching to StorEdge. Easy Storage is really fast. StorEdge is a little cleaner. It's a trade-off, right? And then from there, we have inside of our operations, our management company, we have 3 divisions. One for customer service. They're answering the phones. We have a big Filipino portion of our workforce. They're phenomenal people, an average of $5 to $7 an hour, but super competent. We've been very surprised at how good they are at their job. And so they're answering phones, they're taking payments, they're renting units. Then we have another division that's maintenance. So we have a team in Colombia in the United States that oversees our on the ground vendors, because every property, you need 5 to 10 vendors, which is lawn care, snow plowing, snow removal. You need a boots on the ground person. You got to manage all that stuff. And then we have the last one is collections and auctions. We have 3 people in our company that handle collections and auctions only, right? They're running 42 facilities. You're having monthly auctions at each one. That's a big part of our company as well. So that's kind of how our company is structured and organized.
Very similar. We use Easy Storage Solutions. Our customer service / sales is also outsourced. We like the Philippines as well. We have a number of folks that are working in various areas of our business that way as well. At the end of the day, it's all about systems. Systems run the business and we manage and tweak the system. We literally, when I started this business 17 years ago, I read Michael Gerber's book, The E-Myth, and just recreated that. We created a franchise for our business. There really, as you can say, there was one out there for a little while. But when I looked at that in storage as well as the others and what they offered, just didn't make any sense. This is a simple, predictable business model. Again, I won't ever say that it's easy, because no business is. You got to mine the store. But boy, you want to talk about a business model that can be systematized and really truly achieve success in the E-Myth and creating an E-Myth business and self-storage and basically setting it up like a franchise. And then it's plug and play and just adding on to the mix after that. So let's talk about branding for a minute then, Nick. Are all of your facilities branded the same? Or do you use geographical branding? Tell us a little bit about how you're choosing the names for the brand itself and the facilities.
Yeah, we believe firmly that we should brand all of our facilities the same way for SEO purposes. And again, to get inside of the machine as far as answering phones and making it easier to run our systems. So yeah, we're Bolt Storage. That's the flag that goes up on day one at every property we buy.
And so let's talk a little bit more about how you're gaming the system and beating the competition. Obviously, you've got a lot of SEO mojo and Google juice coming in if you've got that one brand, but There's always the big guys, or not always, depending on the market that you're in, but how do you compete with the REITs, with the Extra Spaces of the world, the U-Haul, the Publix? Because they're always in that little peach colored box above, one, two, or three of them. And then we're below either our brand or with Sparefoot. So how have you been able to game that system and then move yourself up in the rankings in the markets that you operate in?
You know, I don't really like to compete with the REITs. They're good. They're good. We have one property in Pittsburgh, and that's one of a couple properties where we have REIT competition within 3 or 4 miles of us. But for the most part, we're in small towns. I mean, we're in 3,000 person towns. We're growing up. We're getting some bigger properties. Our average facility size is 27,000 square feet now. But it is very hard to drive traffic and rentals in Westmeath, Pennsylvania, right outside of Pittsburgh. It's hard because you have a CubeSmart that was just built around the corner, and they're going to spend more money than anybody on marketing. I don't want to spend $43 a click to potentially rent a unit, right? So, but in the small towns, yeah, it's when you use Sparefoot and Google Ads, those two things, and you have an optimized Google My Business location, those three things, yep, that puts us head and shoulders above almost every other mom and pop. Actually, everyone, right? I don't know a single other mom and pop that has just a basic SEO optimized website, but it's not a lot of direct traffic. You're running a Google AdWords campaign, paying $3 or $4 a click. You have an optimized Google My Business location. In many of our markets, we're the only one on Sparefoot, and we're on Sparefoot in every market. We like Sparefoot, even though it's expensive.
You said you're growing up and average is 27,000 square foot. So it sounds like by design, your buy box has always been in either secondary, but definitely tertiary markets. That has been the business model from the beginning.
Yeah, we have some lenders that are comfortable giving us pretty cheap debt in tertiary markets. I mean, the debt market for self-storage, part of the reason why our industry is getting so hot is because the debt appetite is getting stronger. You have some big regional lenders, some of the biggest commercial lenders in the country that are interested in lending on these assets, even if they're in small towns. So our ideal buy box is a facility that's near full occupancy, but submarket rents in a smaller town, right? So we want to see at least 10 grand a month in revenue. If it's over than that, it can tick our boxes and get us some profitable from a private equity standpoint. We have enough overhead where we're not really doing deals sub $1 million now. Unless they're in a town where we've already acquired an asset, then we'll kind of bolt on a lot of buildings. But yeah, our buy box is over 10 grand a month in revenue, and we want to see pretty full. We want them to be pretty full of customers. But we, you know, an example is we look for markets where the true market rates have not really been determined. In that meaning, like when you're competing against CubeSmart, you know what the market rent is because it's what they're charging. Like their algorithms, they're going to drive revenue so that they're always 94 to 97% occupied. This year, they're 97. They don't even like to be that high, right? They're going to drive rents big time this spring. So we're looking for markets where, okay, maybe they all charge $40 or $50 or $60 for a 10 by 10. But we at Bolt Storage, we've run the numbers. We know that there's not very many units to rent in town. We know that there's not enough supply. So we know we can rent units at $70, $80, $90 for a 10 by 10. That's our perfect buy.
If there's not a REIT in town, it seems like so many people are afraid to be the REIT, if you will. I mean, you're not going to be the REIT, but to be the market leader. And the typical way the market is operated and the competition that is already there is to undercut the competition by a dollar. And they continue to do that in the race to the bottom. And of course, the first one to the bottom loses. They can't afford to stay in business, but they take the whole market down with them because that's the only way they know how to do business. And we've done follow the same model that you have, which is we're going to come in, we're going to clean these facilities up. It's going to be the nicest looking in town. And therefore, we're going to command a premium. And you're welcome to the rest of the competitors as they raise their rates along with us, because we will continue to push rates as we monitor occupancy and somebody has to do it. We might as well be the one. So I guess a little bit of a mind shift, and it sounds very simple, but it's a little bit different if you head into a market, as you said, Nick, that doesn't already have somebody who's pushing rates like a REIT all the time with market rate software where they're analyzing that on a case-by-case basis. Also, any additions, any additional square footage that you're adding, are you building onto these facilities? You're looking for aggressive growth in rates right out of the gate, but what about the 5-acre parcel that only has buildings on 3 acres? Are you expanding?
Absolutely. Yeah. So the next task for quarter one, quarter two, 2022, personally, is we're building out a construction management arm where we are going to get some GCs hired that can help us expand and build more storage at almost all of our stores. I mean, half of the 42 have expansion room, and two or three of them have big projects that need to take place of, as far as a phase development, more than $1 million. We're bringing on a hire next week, actually, who is going to be overseeing that.
Mm-hmm. That's where we started, is buying these mom and pop facilities, classy facilities, taking them up to a B. And if they have room to add buildings onto, that is just all the better. I mean, there's ancillary income streams and many ways to drive NOI. But if we can do it with square footage, that is for us, that has always been the best. And I was earlier this week in Oklahoma City looking at another project, 5 acres that we can build onto, and the existing facility was only 10,000 square foot. I still get just as excited about finding those projects like that as we do when we build a $17 million Class A facility and a major MSA. As a matter of fact, I think I maybe like those a little bit more, as odd as that sounds. I've always been kind of a junker at heart and love to be able to find those opportunities. I don't know about you, Nick. It's almost like my competitive juices get flowing. It's just like, I found this when nobody else did. And then when we buy it and build on it, it's almost like we got one over on the rest of the folks in our town. That's just what excites me.
Yeah, there's nothing better than finding a little bit of in-place income with some potential to build more storage. I mean, so many shops, including us for a little while in 2021, we were not looking at expansion and upside as far as value add. We weren't even underwriting it. So when you can underwrite that expansion and development and 5-year value that creates, you're competing with less buyers. You're doing a little bit of headache, but not much, right? It's only one or two contracts to really get these things built. And it can be very, very profitable.
Well, Nick, I touched on at the beginning, I asked, what are your 2022 plans? But I'd like to take a step back. I mean, you've built a sizable operation. It's a pretty large ship that you can't maneuver this very quickly. And so there has to be a 5 to 10 year to maybe 30 year plan in place. What does that look like overall in terms of where you're heading with this machine that you built?
Yeah, I think we are quite blown away by the performance of our portfolio, as are you probably over the past 9 months. I mean, the assets that we acquired 6 months ago are already performing at their month over month, year three, year four pro forma, just because we're able to drive rents and revenue so much higher than we thought. So we are going to get more aggressive. I mean, we're aggressively underwriting. We have access to cheap debt. Our investor appetite is ready to, our investors only need 12 to 14% IRR to really feel comfortable diving in and buying a storage facility because they know the tailwinds aren't the massive upside and long-term tailwinds, right? So our goal is to build a machine that can buy $100 million a year worth of storage. We want to buy $100 million this year, and we're going to recapitalize. We don't sell, we recap. So we get new equity, we put it on long-term CMBS debt, cheap interest-only loans, and have a 10-year hold period on those assets. So we're going to have some capital infusions by doing that to a few of our early acquisitions, and we're going to keep pouring that capital back into buying and expanding more storage facilities. So Bolt Storage right now, over 1 million square feet, 42 facilities, closing on 43 tomorrow. But in 10 years, I think the self-storage market look a lot different. The REITs might actually want to play in some of these smaller markets. The REITs actually might do remote management. Right now, CubeSmart, Life Storage, Extra Space Storage, the three biggest operators are Public Storage, the four biggest operators, none of them have a single unmanned self-storage facility. They don't have a single one that is ran without a manager. We don't have a single facility that's ran with a manager. So at what point does technology keep up? At what point do these REITs want to get into this business and play? I think by 10 years from now, there's a pretty good chance that some of them will be doing that. And when that happens, you don't bank on these things as an underwriter, but it will be nice to see what happens to our cap rates when that cheap capital comes into our markets. So by the time that happens, we want to have 500 or 600 stores and be one of the biggest private operators in the country.
It's a great plan. And when you play the value add game, that's one way of looking at it. But then also, we've been able to sell to our buyers, the REITs. If they've got 2% money, they have no problem paying a 4 cap for a project because their yield is the same as us when I'm buying in a 7 cap because I got 5% money. Mm-hmm. You do the math, 2 or 3 basis points is what we're looking at in the spread. And so, yes, when they come down into those markets, eventually we were buying at the 7-8 caps on today's dollars and interest rates in these Class C facilities and tertiary markets. Yeah, the yield spread is going to get a little bit larger when the less expensive money comes in. And this, for us, the play has always been that this is one of the last Wild West frontiers, if you will, of real estate, and that the REITs, they dominate the other asset classes. And there's very few mom and pops that are left. But self-storage, you know, when I got in 15 years ago, the REITs had about a 10% presence. They're approaching 15 to 17% now, depending on who you look at. And so if it's not the REITs, it's the funds. There's always a bigger fish now. And as you mentioned, there's a whole lot of folks that are coming into this space. Banks love self-storage, especially as we head into a recession, because it has the lowest loan default rate, lowest loan loss rate. And this is what they want on their balance sheet as they head into a recession. So there's lots of money chasing self-storage on the lending side. And same with the private equity. We're experiencing the same. In an inflationary period, everybody exits the stock market and they want a hard asset. And so we don't have any challenges in getting capital for our projects. It is back to that speed is the name of the game for looking at how fast and how we can handle our growth. So that being said, recognize we both love self-storage. I got into the business looking as a different way to have a different retirement vehicle versus the retirement I was going to have in my 401k for a Fortune 500 job. And then when that company went belly up in the dot-com crash of 99, that's when I began really doubling down on self-storage. And it, since then, to be honest with you, Nick, I haven't searched very hard, but I've asked the folks that I know that are out there doing and starting other businesses. And they said, hey, if you find anything that beats self-storage for what I feel is just an incredible business model, then let me know and I'll be the first to jump in. But you do, you have your hand in a number of different businesses and different industries and asset classes. So tell me a little bit about what excites you and the reason for diversification instead of just focusing and doubling down on storage.
I think I'm very passionate about small business, but I think the trajectory of every entrepreneur should be to work your way to easier businesses, right? When you have no money, no leverage, no capital, you have to start out in some harder businesses. And that's what we did with our service company. Now we're working our way towards self-storage. I don't think I'm going to get distracted, right? We sit down every day and we say, we just need to block and tackle for the next 5 years and we're going to do amazing things. So I wouldn't say that I'm distracted personally, but as far as what I'm passionate about, and for the folks listening, there is no better way to start and hit the ground running and learn about operations and feel confident in negotiating and selling yourself and your ideas to employees and investors and customers than starting a small business. And so I'm super passionate about it. I have a brand called The Sweaty Startup. That's how you found me. Podcast called The Sweaty Startup. And I mean, I am super passionate about running small businesses because you look at entrepreneurship. We walk around to anybody who says, what do you think is entrepreneurship? You go to somebody on the street. And they say, oh, I think of Mark Zuckerberg, Elon Musk, and Steve Jobs. But what is true entrepreneurship? True entrepreneurship is the people in our towns and our cities that are building generational wealth by running small businesses. And many of those people are not, they don't consider themselves entrepreneurs. They don't study management. They're not serious about sales. They're not serious about marketing. They frankly don't really know too much about what they're doing, but some of them are making millions of dollars and doing really well for themselves. So if you think about starting a company, you can go the tech route, the online route, the scalable route, or you can go to your small town where the competition is weaker, the risk is lower. There's a lot of people already doing it. You're not trying to invent a new idea. You're not trying to train a market. You can just go out there and get your piece of the pie. So I feel really strongly that my small business background, my operational history, where we were running companies and dealing with employees, it set me up for so much success in real estate. And business is about momentum. It started with you in 2000 when you lost your job and you started a small business. And then from there, it was up, 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 and you're rolling your capital in. And now you're in self-storage and you're building generational wealth for your family. My story is very, very similar. And you look at most entrepreneurs, most of their stories are also very similar, where it's a momentum play, right? They didn't start out as a multimillionaire with 10 self-storage facilities. They started out with maybe a small business that made 10 grand a month. And then it was 20 grand a month. And then they only spent 10, so they had an extra 10 grand a month for a couple of years. And then they were able to go buy a real estate asset. Then they refinanced that real estate asset and went and bought more, right? So if you really think about entrepreneurship from a 10-year lens and how much money do I need? What's the lowest risk way for me to get there? There's no better opportunity than small business today.
Yeah. And I think many people have that lens that you mentioned, Nick. People that hear you or myself for the first time, they'll say, well, Nick, that guy's super successful. And man, it looks like he's an overnight success. Look at that, what he did just last year. And they don't realize that you are an overnight success 10, 12 years in the making. And then they don't look at the heavy lifting that goes into the big push. Jim Collins talks about in Good to Great. It takes so much heavy lifting to get the flywheel going. But then after you do, and you have the systems in place and the staff to be able to do so, it doesn't take as much after that. But 100% agree. We're in the legacy building stage. And I look at my kids in the ways that we are teaching the folks that come through our doors at our self-storage academy. And that is, how do they build generational wealth? And it isn't so much that the vehicle is always self-storage. It's just, it's the mindset and the process of being able to do so, as you mentioned. And even if you listen to Gary Vee, another, you know, one of our marketing guys that we look to, he said, just go to Goodwill, start buying some stuff and selling it on eBay, and you'll get a sense for and a feel for what it's like to run your own business. Let it take its course. But anybody can get out there and do the hustle and the grind and start and build something rather than trading hours for dollars. So 100% agree. So that being said, we're nearing the end of our time here, Nick. Tell us about that phase, either the phase of your business life cycle or having the time to be able to now begin thinking about legacy and passing on to others that you're teaching and reaching through your podcast or in conversations or otherwise. What does that look like now? And how are you gaining momentum and teaching and showing other folks how to do what you've done?
If you think about the different career paths that somebody can take, whether it be corporate America, working for a small company, working for a big company, or starting your own company, there is none of them where very few of them, where the older you get, the less you can work and the more money you can make. That's a very critical thing to wrap your mind around. Hey, I can find a business where I can get older, I can earn more money, and I can work less. And so, yeah, we started out moving boxes and we made only 40 grand in our very first whole year of hard work. Nowadays, I'm working less, having more fun, and making more money than I ever thought possible. So yeah, I think I'm just super, super passionate about encouraging more competent people who have a little bit of management chops, have the courage to go out. Maybe they have some financial backing from family and friends so that the worst case scenario isn't the end of the world if you fail in business, right? We live in America, right? You're not going to go hungry here if you have some family that loves you and a couple things to lean back on. I'm blessed enough that I was born and have that going for me. But yeah, I think my mission as a human now, and if you want to follow me on Twitter, it's at Sweaty Startup. I talk about wealth. I talk about being happy. I've been thinking more lately about what leads to a successful life and a happy life. And many of the richest people I know are not happy. So it's kind of tough, right? Life is hard for everybody, including the wealthy people. So trying to figure out how to live a healthy and happy and rewarding life is part of the struggle. But that's what I'm focused on over the next 5 or 10 years. And the Sweaty Startup brand is just trying to open people's eyes about entrepreneurship the real way, not the stuff you read about on TechCrunch and Shark Tank and things like that.
Well, I appreciate your work, being able to admire from afar, Nick, and I'm glad that we had the time to be able to catch up, because the work that you are doing is inspirational and it's true. The Sweaty Startup is just that. It takes that heavy lifting, but the joy that you can have and the contentment of sitting back and enjoying something that you own, or even if you are in the middle of it in a season where you are working hard, it is something that you're building and it is something that is your own. And so you've been a master at just showing people how to truly enjoy the journey as well. Your podcast, your writings have been uplifting. So I applaud you for your work and appreciate the time we had together today.
Yeah, and I thank you, because it's guys like you who are further ahead than me in their journey and have done more that we kind of get mentorship on the side by listening to you online. So we're really thankful that you put stuff out there, and I'm glad you had me on. I'm honored to be a part of what you're building. So thank you for having me.
My pleasure, Nick. All right. So you've talked a couple of ways about how folks can find you by way of Twitter and a Sweaty Startup. What are some of the best ways or other ways that you want people to be able to follow you and find exactly what you're doing?
Yeah. So I have a real estate podcast that is in the weeds on real estate private equity with a heavy skew towards self-storage. It's called The Nick Huber Show. And I have the Sweaty Startup podcast about small business. I release one episode a week. And I have a website, sweatystartup.com. And there you can get on my newsletter. I send out deal breakdowns as far as self-storage goes that are really popular. If you want to hop on my email newsletter, I think, and sending me a note on Twitter is always a good way too.
Beautiful. All right, Nick. Well, as we leave here, what are some parting words of wisdom that you have for our folks before we sign off for today?
You know, it's really easy to look at guys like Scott and guys like me who are now buying bigger buildings and doing bigger things, but understanding that all it takes is one small self-storage facility to change your life is really kind of something that a lot of people don't understand. I mean, my very first deal that we bought after our construction was a $400,000 deal. It was the one in Pittsburgh. And within a year, we had it cruising along and it was worth $800,000. And that is life-changing money for anybody. I don't care who you are. So some of those small deals that you don't have to have a big resume, you don't have to have Bolt Storage on your cover letter. You can find a way to buy one of those deals from a small-time owner, and it can have you on your way to an awesome journey.
And I would agree and add on to that. The very first facility that I purchased, I had very little money into it because I had a partnership who brought most of the money and some of the credit into the deal. We were net cash flowing to $10,000 a month. And for myself also, yeah, life-changing, that one small self-storage facility. So that is the way to do it, folks. You do not have to build something gigantic out of the gate. It just needs to be something that you start with. So Nick, I appreciate that. I appreciate our time once again. And I look forward to the second podcast when we have you back. So appreciate you, appreciate your time, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Take care, Nick.
Hey, gang. Wait, three things before you leave. First, don't forget to subscribe to the Self Storage Podcast and turn on your notifications so you never miss another episode. And while you're there, please leave us a 5-star review if you like the show. Second, be sure to share your favorite episodes and more via Instagram, and don't forget to tag us. And lastly, head to the links in the show description and hit the follow and subscribe button on Twitter and Facebook to get a front row seat as we grow and scale our business and bring you along with us. Take care.